What is conversion? It's a very typical word that we use. We've heard a little bit already in some of the past presentations about how conversion, along with preaching, has a particular Christian Protestant context out of which it comes in the English language. And so that also carries over certain connotations of the history of Christianity in the term itself. So I'm going to be looking at what conversion means, different ways of understanding how conversion actually takes place in particular religions, very briefly, drawing from some comparative examples of different faiths. And then I'm going to, in the second part of the presentation, focusing more on examples from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, particularly of early conversions to Gaudiya Vaishnavism, what that looked like and what it might be able to tell us today about what conversion might mean for our tradition. Alright, so religious conversion is a concept that is surprisingly hard to define. One popular way of viewing conversion, following the Western Protestant model, largely derived from readings of Paul in the New Testament, is that conversion is an individual, private matter, and relates to doctrine, a change in belief, and an instantaneous and total change in one's life. It could almost be seen as a revolution of sorts. When Paul is on the road to Damascus and has his vision of Christ affecting a total commitment to his new path of Christianity, a conversion model was set for the Christian community that still holds through today in many ways. This particular image of conversion is one that many scholars now, such as Peter van der Veer and Gauri Vishwanathan, would argue against, however, insisting that conversion from one religion to another is in many cases not so rarefied and individualistic, but may depend more on one's community, one's social setting, political or cultural factors, among other things. In fact, it may be very hard to separate religion from the rest of life and the rest of society. And so in that sense, a religious conversion can frequently include a type of cultural conversion and social conversion as well. Looking at the form and meaning of conversion highlights both what conversion looks like on a social and practical level, on the one hand, and what it insinuates about a person's agency and identity, on the other hand. However, for most Western converts to Islam particularly, especially in the first two decades of Islam's existence, conversion actually did mean changing all of the above, making a radical step out of what one saw as one's native culture, and adopting practices that were very different than the typical Westerner at the time. So that was at least temporarily what conversion looked like in Islam. Now I think you might agree it can be quite different. In any case, however, conversion is generally witnessed as a change of religious identity or community membership. So identity is the key word there. It can be manifest in one's beliefs, practices, one's lifestyle, the association one keeps. So what does religious membership really mean, genuinely mean? Most of us in this room would call ourselves Chaitanya Vaishnavas. Do we all mean the same thing when we say that? When we adopt Gaudiya Vaishnavism in its beliefs, its practices, the cultural context in which we received it, is it a package system that appears the same to each one of us in our different contexts? Do we all adopt the exact same thing? And if someone leaves, do they leave the exact same thing? Does it contain all the exact same elements in the same proportions at all times? Most observers would dispute that it does, in fact. Interrogating the differences in motivations among converts or members of a religious group, J. Wascom Pickett, who was a missionary in India and later a bishop of the United Methodist Church in the early 20th century, conducted a survey published in 1933 on Indian Christian converts. He asked nearly 4,000 individuals, "Why did you become a Christian?" He received a long list of answers, and I'll just give you a short sample of six that I think cover the spectrum of different possibilities. So one person answered, "I became a Christian because I was tired of the devil." Another, "I became a Christian to change my character." Another, "I became a Christian to escape from cholera." Another one, "I became a Christian to marry a good girl." Another, "I became a Christian so that I could amount to something in life and go to heaven." And finally, "I became a Christian because I was sorry for my sins." So quite a spectrum or a range of possibilities, right? Ranging from the spiritual, the theological, or doctrinal, right down to the very practical material reasons that led, in fact, in India to, I think, the phrase rice Christians, right? That I became a Christian because the Christian missionaries were offering my family rice if we converted. Right? So it can be very different reasons for conversion. And so the circumstances of conversion does differ from person to person. The form and the meaning of what it is to join a religious community can also differ over time and over cultural context. Larry Shin highlights the difference in the reality of conversion to Gaudiya Vaishnavism in his article called The Maturation of the Hare Krishnas in America. In his work, he found there were also vastly different reasons the devotees had joined ISKCON. This was published in 1994. He writes, "One of the things that caused me to correct my initial prejudices about the Krishnas was that those who joined the movement came through several modes of conversion and from many different backgrounds. Satsarup Das, who later was appointed one of Prabhupada's guru successors, was one of the earliest devotees I met," he writes. "He was in his late 20s when I met him in New York City. He had discovered the Krishnas as a result of a spiritual quest which was satisfied within this Indian tradition. In my research, I found quite a few previously Christian or Jewish youth who, as devotees, are sincerely religious persons. But," he goes on to say, "I also met other devotees who were running away from something or running away from someone, an unsatisfactory university life, a broken relationship with a family member or a loved one, or just running away from American material culture itself. Many were attracted to the food of ISKCON, to the reclusive life in its temples, or the close family feel of its lifestyles. Most of the people in this group did not last very long in the movement, but some moved on to more devoted religious practice. Yet a third group of devotees were those who found a particular feature of this Hindu religion very attractive. Some were drawn specifically to its intricate theology and philosophy, more on the doctrinal end but also the aesthetic end. Each day within a Krishna temple, the Sanskrit scriptures are read, expositions are given, and chanting of the name of Krishna occurs. This creates for many devotees a sense of religious community that is appealing. Whatever their reasons for joining the Krishnas, as he calls them, for most of the devotees I interviewed, it usually took approximately 2 years from the time of first contact before they became full-time devotees inside a Krishna temple." End quote from Larry Shin. This kind of vision, looking at different, you know, motivations for conversion, different experiences once you have converted, also finds resonance in the Bhagavad Gita. You may be familiar with the verse 7:16, which talks about the four types of persons who come to bhajante, as it says, to worship or to enact devotion to Krishna. One is the distressed or the afflicted, the artha. Another is the inquisitive. Another, the one who gains, who has a desire for gain of some sort. And finally, one who is wise or interested in acquiring wisdom. So even there, there's a sense of variety in the conversion process and among converts themselves. However, with that in mind, beyond motivations, conversion, or generally converts specifically, tend to be measured by their physical numbers rather than by their motivations. Sika points is one way of talking about that that used to be more common in our society. They tend to be measured by concrete or institutionalized membership in a religious organization. This institutional-based notion of conversion does not always overlap neatly with a more internal spiritual notion of conversion. They're not always matching up entirely. So then, what do numbers of physical converts actually tell us about people's personal religious lifestyle or worldview? To what extent can or should one measure conversion in Gaudiya Vaishnavism by numbers or by identity in a particular religious community? In order to explore this, I want to divert a little bit and take a few comparative examples from other faiths and other cultures that might add something to the discussion that hasn't been brought up so far. I'm going to draw from two comparative examples, both in the South Asian context broadly. The first one from Islamic traditions that spread widely in Bengal, roughly during the same period that Chaitanya Vaishnavism spread in Bengal, so an interesting parallel example there. And the second one from the Ismailis, who are again an Islamic group, but a division of Shia Muslims, who have been very popular in India and what is now Pakistan. The Ismailis, however, are a bit different from other Muslims, you could say, in that they tend to incorporate a lot of what we would call Hindu or even Vaishnav elements in their worship and in their tradition, so that at some points it's hard to tell, you know, who are these people? Are they Hindus, are they Muslims, or are they something else altogether? And these Ismailis I'm going to be looking at briefly in the study are going to be, it's going to be a study that was based on Ismailis in Rajasthan, as we all know, in the area around, you know, west of Uttar Pradesh during the late medieval period. So through the histories of Vaishnavism and South Asian Islam, though they're vastly different, of course, and by putting them up to comparison, I don't mean that they're parallel, I hope this will be an interesting exercise in discussing what conversion might mean, what it could mean, and to what extent the meaning and form of conversion may change drastically as it is on the ground over time and place. All right, so first, I'll look at the work of Richard Eaton, who is a scholar of South Asian Islam, who's particularly worked on Islam in Bengal. He undertakes a broad historical survey of Islam in Bengal, beginning in the pre-Turkish conquest period. So this is the period from the 13th century onward in Bengal. Eaton pinpoints the processes by which large numbers of Bengalis became Muslim, and in doing so challenges several very popular theories about conversion, particularly in relation to conversion to Islam. First, to situate this theory, I'm going to give a little bit of geographic and historical background, which would be much improved if I had a map, but unfortunately, I apologize for that. But if you can visualize for a moment the landscape of Greater Bengal, what is now Bengal and Bangladesh. Bengal, especially in the eastern area of the delta, is a place of abundant rivers and tributaries. Huge amounts of rain comes through here in the monsoon season, and if you've ever looked at a map of this area, it's just abundant with rivers and different streams. From prehistoric times through the main period of Brahmanical settlement in the delta, the principal channel of the Ganges flowed down the delta's westernmost corridor through what is now the Bhagirathi-Hubli channel in the west. By the 13th century, in the kingdom of Lakshman Sen, who we may know was the patron of Jayadeva Goswami, who wrote the Gita Govinda. So at that time, in the 13th century, most of Bengal, west of the Kautoya River, had become settled by an agrarian population, cultivating the land, cultivating rice, and also cultivating urban centers where scholarship, culture, literacy was quite popular. In the east, however, east of the Kautoya and south of the Padma River, the land was basically either marsh or forest, and was generally seen as a hinterland, sort of something far off that no one really went unless they had to, much less no one had actually urbanized, you could say. This, of course, enabled Lakshman Sen, when the Turkish armies came upon his kingdom, to escape to this eastern part of Bengal. And you can see what a hinterland it was that he could escape safely and hide out in this area because it was completely undeveloped. However, it wasn't unpopulated. It had a large population of, I guess we'd say, tribal peoples, people living in the forest, but not having settled agriculture and settled communities. And also, it was not considered either part of the Brahminical culture and that area, or part of the expanding Turkish Empire in northern India. Now, at this time, there had been a long-term eastward movement of the great river systems that go throughout Bengal. And by the late 16th century, the Ganges linked up with the Padma River, just at the time that Akbar and the Mughal Empire was launching efforts to incorporate the entire Bengal Delta into the Mughal Empire. As a result, the Ganges carried the Mughal conquerors very easily straight into what had been for previous Maharajas and Sultans practically inaccessible land. Now, what happened next, we will leave for a moment, and I'm going to fast forward quickly to 1871, which is a significant year for the history of South Asia, because it's the first British census of South Asia. And the British did something that hadn't been done before, at least as far as we know, in that they, for the first time, wanted to record the Indian population, and particularly the religions of the Indian population. So in 1871, they took the first census and systematically attempted to group people according to it. There they found, according to that, to everyone's surprise, including the Bengalis themselves, that up to 70% of Bengal was Islamic. So what happened in between? There have been several theories that have gained precedence in the academy since the British colonial period that have tried to account for this history and this proliferation of conversions to Islam among Bengalis. The first is the immigration theory. Basically, this posits that a vast majority of Bengal's Muslims are descendants of Muslims who migrated to Bengal via the Arabian Sea or overland through North India. So in this case, there was not mass conversion in Bengal, there was just mass immigration of millions of people. Any cursory look at the people in question, however, what to speak of the historical record, yields very little support for this thesis. A second theory is the religion of the sword thesis, which is a popular one for especially European scholarship historically in explaining conversion to Islam. It's been a very convenient explanation, at least since the time of the Crusades, and received a big boost in the 19th century during the heyday of especially British colonialism, when, you know, for many reasons, the British wanted to downplay previous powers or previous cultures that had had dominance. We might see the Aryan invasion theory to carry a similar motivation, but that's another topic for another time. However, one runs into a big problem with this religion of the sword thesis when we begin to look at the layout of the conversions that we're talking about. Generally, the greatest populations of conversion to Islam in South Asia are in an inverse relationship to the seats of Islamic power. So the greatest populations of conversion in Bengal were precisely in these eastern areas that were less developed, even after the Mughal conquerors came in, that were less developed, less urbanized. A similar situation exists in Kashmir as well. So that theory doesn't seem to find much historical evidence in terms of mass conversion. A third theory is what Eaton calls the religion of the social, or the social liberation theory. So this, you probably have also heard of, is the idea that Brahminical groups were very much entrenched in power and were oppressing all of the other population, and that lower caste groups felt quite unsatisfied with this and wanted to rebel against the caste system, and they saw another religion, be it Islam or in some cases Christianity, which was egalitarian and which would accept them as, you know, as a soul without any caste distinctions. So that was another popular theory that was used to explain how the conversion happened in such big numbers. Now, there's a problem with that theory as well, or two problems, we could say. The first one is that all the historical evidence shows that neither Islam nor Christianity, for that matter, was egalitarian in a practical social sense in India at this time. The caste distinctions largely remained and do remain between converts. And so there wasn't any, and in addition to that, there may not have actually been a strong sense in which they understood that they could rebel against a Brahminical hierarchy to another option. That option just didn't, you know, wasn't there in the same way that we might imagine it to be. There's also an inverse relationship between the areas, again, of large Muslim conversion and the areas of strong Brahminical hierarchy. So again, you think, if it is an issue of, you know, rebelling against the Brahminical authority, then the areas where the Brahmins are most entrenched or most popular, those would be the areas in which we get the greatest conversions, right? Okay, so not right in this case. In this case, it's actually those areas which are least occupied by Brahminical structures in which we find the most conversions. And again, you know, in the east and south of the Bengali Delta and the plains, not clustered around the cities and the traditional seats of Brahminical power. So how do we explain conversion here? Richard Eaton suggests that the shift in the river delta provides an important clue. The main Islamic conversion took place from the 16th century on, when the shift in the delta enabled the Mughal ships to sail straight down the Ganges and into the eastern hinterlands. When these vast eastern and southern lands were developed, many, though not all, of the land grants were given to agriculturally based Sufis, who in turn recruited the forest-dwelling tribes and taught them both agriculture, how to cultivate land and live in a sustainable, set place, and they also taught them reading and writing, literacy. But of course, in the teaching of reading and writing, the language and the culture that introduced them to was the Islamic culture and its religion, and its kind of entire civilizational whole, one could say. However, this Islam was not as strongly Arabic Islam that has become so popular in our representations in the last century. It was a Bengali Islam that located its roots and place as a native tradition of Bengal, where Adam himself was said to have descended, and in a popular 16th century Bengali Islamic text, Adam was given the command by the angel Gabriel, Niranjan, or the Supreme Lord, has commanded that agriculture be your destiny. So there's this sense in which agriculture and their identification with Islam or with that particular religion were very much intertwined. As much do we see developed theology or developed theological arguments against other traditions. In addition to that, these particular Muslim Bengalis also frequently coupled their worship of Allah with worship of the goddess or yogic practice. Alright, so then we have to kind of reconsider, in what sense do we call these, can we still call this a conversion? If so, to what? Or what kind of conversion? Eaton, in this regard, likens the spread of Islam in Bengal not to the religion of the sword, but the religion of the plow and the religion of the book, due to its agricultural connections. He writes something that I think, even though this is a very contextual example, and of course this is a conference on Gaudiya Vaishnavism, not on Islam in Bengal, he writes something that I think can be useful for us in a very broad sense. It would be wrong to view Islam as some impersonal agency that simply expanded across space, time, and social class, in the process assimilating great numbers of people into a single framework of piety. Rather, the religion was itself continuously reinterpreted as different social classes and different periods became its dominant carriers. Right, so in the 13th century, when the first Turkish conquerors came into Bengal, Islam was associated with the ruling ethos of the Turkish elite. In the 16th century, the Mughals came in and changed that type of Islam to more a Persian-influenced literary and artistic version of Islam. Later than that, after the 18th century, Islam became more the possession of the peasant cultivators in the countryside, not an urban phenomenon, but much more of a rural agricultural phenomenon. Right, so in the process, it also changed the face of what it looked like to be a Muslim, the face of what it looked like to convert. Eaton argues that this process of becoming Muslim, as Bengalis understand it today, occurred over such a long period of time that one can at no point identify a specific moment of conversion, or any single moment when people saw themselves as having made a dramatic break with the past, the kind of Pauline notion of, consciously choosing a particular doctrine and breaking with one's past. This notion of conversion thus falls a long way from that individual climactic decision to adopt a particular set of doctrines, doctrine-centered, belief-centered, view about spiritual reality. The notion of seeing religious systems as separate and impermeable systems of what Peter van der Veer calls culture boxes, containing everything in a very monolithic way, that kind of notion also has its problems when one begins to consider the history of shared religious identity for many individuals. This becomes poignant, particularly in the case of the Ismailis of South Asia. In Dominique Sheila Khan's Conversion and Shifting Identities, a study of the Ismailis of Rajasthan, he notes that in general, the Ismailis in North India tended to draw as much from Vaishnav sources as they did from Muslim sources. For instance, incorporating the Dash avatar system into their theology and positing Ali, the son-in-law of Muhammad, as the 10th avatar, or Kaki, and also linking other figures in Muhammad's life to different Indian deities. Ismaili missionaries converted numerous communities in Rajasthan, but many of these communities in the modern context reinterpret their history and reaffiliate themselves with Rajput Hindu history, having kind of a double conversion process over a few hundred years. The adoption of a new religious affiliation involves complex processes, however, The Rajputas, mainly who, being originally a Hindu in the broad sense of the term, then embraced Ismailism, and then made several centuries later, during the rise of Islamic nationalism, was made to adopt a very particular Sunni type of Islam, he's said to have been twice converted to Islam. Meanwhile, there's ample evidence that those who did convert to Ismailism and reverted back to Hindu traditions around the rise of nationalism in the 19th and 20th centuries hold beliefs now that are different from what they had held previous to their conversion. So, have they gone back to their previous beliefs, or is it something different altogether? Again, a double conversion. Conversely, for those Ismailis who chose to remain Muslims, there is a tendency nowadays to forsake the striking Hindu appearances of their ways and their traditions and to revert back to the Arab garb of Islam. For instance, in 1957, a decision was made by the Imam, the leader of the Ismailis, that the daily prayer, which had previously been recited in vernacular languages, should now be recited in Arabic, and that the word Swami, which was previously the common word to describe the spiritual teacher in their religious literature, be replaced by Mullah. So this conversion seems to be a real process that is constantly changing as their social and political context changes. So, how is this relevant to Chaitanya Vaishnavism? One can certainly see how the process of becoming a member of a religious community or conversion can take vastly different courses, not always even centering on the religious aspect of the conversion. Conversion in these cases has as much, if not more, to do with knowledge acquiring, broadening one's social and political horizons and identity, as it does with a certain choice for a particular doctrine or a set of metaphysical beliefs and practices. For these Bengali Muslims, as for Indonesian Muslims or South Indian Muslims generally, the last 150 years has dealt them particular cultural and political shifts, leading to a further conversion to Islam, or more accurately, an Arabizing of their practice of Islam. So is this conversion to Islam, or is this conversion to a particular form of modern Islam? It may be as much modernity in its broad nationalistic and communal focus as an articulation of the Quran and its teachings. And for that reason, you'll hear Peter van der Veer edited the volume on conversion to modernities. But the basic idea to all of that is also followed up that the notion of conversion to religion, again, is not something that is necessarily separate from, you know, one's social political context and has implications on all levels. All right, so having said all of that, unlike Islam and Christianity, Gaudiya Vaishnavism has not been tied historically to the broad political sovereignty that would enable transcultural mass conversions of that nature. The Gaudiya Vaishnavism has been taken up now in all areas of the world by different people, coming from various cultural backgrounds. We have a broad array of that today. One difference between the picture that Richard Eaton paints of Islam in Bengal and the picture of conversion that we receive in Gaudiya Vaishnava literature, like the Chaitanya Charitamrita, is the nature of conversion. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we receive numerous narrations of specific conscious conversions of one person or a group of people to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Sometimes we are told that these people are already part of another faith community. Haridas Thakur or the Pathan soldiers were part of the Muslim communities, and many of those inspired by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu on his visit to South India were Hindus of other sorts, even other Vaishnavas, followers of Ramanuja or Madhva. From my reading of Chaitanya Charitamrita, it seems that the cornerstones of what is called conversion, what I, you know, can take the liberty of calling conversion, are the chanting of Krishna's names and the cultivation of bhakti, two things that are centered on practice and also, in some sense, individuality. Some conversions entail renunciation or asceticism, a broad change in lifestyle, as in the case you could say of Rupa, Sanatan, Raghunath Das Goswami, if we can call those conversions. Though at no time does the ascetic or the breakaway standard seem to be the expected, no normal conversion. Except perhaps at an earlier time in ISKCON, we could think of that. But conversely, the bulk of the Chaitanya Vaishnava community has existed in very loosely organized domestic settings, spread throughout a large area, and in interaction and coexistence with other groups in society. And actually, Joseph O'Connell did some interesting work on this, I think a few articles for the ICJ, in which he noted that the Chaitanya Vaishnava community historically has been a very broad-based, decentralized community without kind of single centralized authority like we might find in the Roman Catholic Church, for instance. And that the notion of conversion and membership has accordingly been something that relies more on what he calls soft institutionalization, more on one's personal appropriation of teachings and one's personal relationship with a guru or with other devotees. So other conversions documented in the Chaitanya Charitamrita portray a change in philosophy, as in Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and Prakashananda Saraswati and his followers. And yet other conversions in the Chaitanya Charitamrita seem to center on an emotional experience, an experience of what's in the text called prema bhakti, as for the villagers in the kirtans that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu led throughout South India. However, throughout all of these, be they focused on an emotional experience of prema, more intellectual Vedantic experience of debating the nature of the absolute truth, or an experience of renunciation or giving up the past type of life, all of these conversions seem to be really centered on this practice of chanting, Krishna Nam, and the cultivation of devotion particularly. So I'm going to go a little bit through the Chaitanya Charitamrita to draw out a few of these examples. In Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's visit to South India, recorded in the 7th chapter of the Majjhima, many conversion narratives abound. As he travels through the villages through his dancing and chanting, immersed in or possessed by love, prema aveshe, he attracts those around him, and his beauty compels them to chant the names of Krishna, again with prema, as it's recorded in Majjhima 7:81. With no further elaboration, these villagers are said to have become Vaishnavas, the main qualification seeming to be their chanting of Krishna's names with the quality of prema. The villagers, in turn, would then spread the chanting of Krishna's names to their fellow villagers, and so on from there. And, in this way, the Chaitanya Charitamrita tells us that the residents of all of the lands in South India became Vaishnava, Sarvadesha Vaishnava, through this method. If there was more to their process of becoming a Vaishnava, or becoming Vaishnavas, it's not elaborated there. Again, the point is reiterated in the text 116 of the same chapter, that in seeing Chaitanya, they became Vaishnavas and started to chant Krishna's names, again, possessed by prema, prema avesha. Chaitanya's advice to the Kurma Brahmin around the same time in South India, and to others later in the Majjhima chapter 7, also seems to follow this pattern of a type of simplicity of conversion and the lack of necessity to dramatically change one's life or one's position in order to convert to Vaishnavism. Other conversion processes are more philosophically centered, which I think does add an interesting nuance to our discussion yesterday on the relative orthodoxy or orthopraxy of Chaitanya Vaishnavism. In the meeting with the Pathan soldiers in Majjhima chapter 18, verses 206 and following, the main point of discussion and the pivot around which religious difference is centered is the discussion of the nature of Brahman, that is, whether Brahman is ultimately impersonal or personal, nirvishesha or savishesha, as it's said in the text. The Chaitanya Charitamrita is keen to establish that not only in its own scriptures or for Chaitanya Vaishnavism itself is Ishvara, the ultimate Lord, savishesha, possessed of a satchidananda deha, and even possessed of the color shama, bluish black, but that also Ishvara has these qualities in the Quran as well. And this, if you remember, is the kind of discussion that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has with these soldiers. I find it interesting that throughout the entirety of this lengthy narrative between Chaitanya and the Pathan soldiers, that not one mention of differences in practice or in lifestyle is mentioned, until text 204, when the peer, the main person debating with Chaitanya, falls at his feet and entreats him to speak on sadhya and sadhana, the goal and the process of attaining it. To which Chaitanya replies to him that his chanting of Krishna Nama has already provided the purified, pavitra state one would attain through sadhana. They in turn, speaking the name of Krishna, become, again, prema aveshe, overwhelmed with love, overwhelmed with prema. So this theme just runs throughout practically all of these, what I would call conversion narratives. Even lengthier conversion processes are recorded in regard to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and Prakashananda Saraswati and followers. And there is well the philosophical Vedantic aspect of Chaitanya Vaishnavism, with the centrality of the Nirvishesha Savishesha issue to one's religious identity, is underscored. Not only conversion, but also liberation itself, is not possible without the Savishesha notion of the absolute truth, according to these dialogues. Because this Savishesha notion is what enables one to develop devotion or to develop prema. It's said in Madhya Lila 25:30, bhakti vina mukti nahi. So without bhakti, there is no mukti, there is no liberation. Chanting Krishna's names is seen as basically synonymous with this in the particular verse that I was speaking of. And then also again in Madhya Lila 6:241, nam sankirtan is said by Chaitanya to be the best bhakti sadhana. So again, this very close relationship. Also assuming, however, that their chanting of Krishna's names was something that was imbued with prema, imbued with this special emotional quality. It is also this cultivation of prema bhakti, which is called the mula prayojana, the root or chief goal for the jiva, or the living being, in Madhya Lila 25:104. Bhakti Vinod Thakur develops this understanding further in his Jiva Dharma. Here, conversion is seen in relation to the idea that the jiva has a true identity beyond current psychophysical coverings or existence. And through taking shelter in Krishna Bhakti, the jiva can move from the bahir mukha prakriti, so the path of kind of outward facing, or the outward tendency, to the antar mukha prakriti, towards what Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls nitya dharma, the eternal dharma of the jiva. Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes regarding this understanding that no material object can support one's attainment of the transcendent goal. The only thing, he writes, that facilitates this is the awakening of the inclination towards Ishvara. This inclination is inherent within the Jivatma and is gradually strengthened and converted into bhakti when one utters the name of God, recites his lilas, and receives inspiration from beholding the divine form, the Sri Vigraha. The Lord's spiritual form, he writes, can be experienced only by pure bhakti, not by jnana or karma. So that alludes back to Rupa Goswami's famous definition of bhakti as well, and sort of the central place that I think the practice of bhakti, the practice of relationship with a personal Ishvara or absolute occupies for our tradition. Along these lines, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, in his treatise on Brahman and Vaishnava, argues also that there is actually no conversion in an ultimate sense, since to be initiated into the Vaishnava tradition is a kind of reinstallation of a state that is latent in the heart of all living beings and is never lost, although it may be covered. Through these examples, I would argue that there is something about the cultivation or the reawakening of Krishna prema, prema bhakti, that is at the heart of genuine conversion and the genuine conversion process according to Gaudiya Vaishnavism. This seems to point toward our philosophy of personalism and also toward what conversion in its most genuine spiritual sense means to Gaudiya Vaishnavism, and can be encapsulated in the famous verse from Krishnadas Kaviraj, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sabja Kabunai Shravanadi Shuddha Chitte Kaya Udai. Krishna Prema is not to be gained at any time because it's eternally there in our consciousness, situated in our chitta, and by hearing it, the process of hearing, it awakens, it comes out again. So in that understanding, one's participation or membership, even an articulation of a particular religious identity, can be left kind of ambiguous. We can see this kind of ambiguity in, you know, who is a Vaishnava, who is not a Vaishnava, in Srila Prabhupada's insistence that St. Francis of Assisi was a Vaishnava, or also in the instance when the devotees were in Tehran, and having Harinam parties on the streets and finding that nobody wanted to chant Krishna's names, they came back to Prabhupada and told him, "We feel like we haven't done our mission. They just want to chant the names of Allah." And Prabhupada replied, "Are you trying to make this a sectarian movement?" So a very broad notion of what conversion means, right? I think what bhakti might mean as well. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, kind of in a similar understanding, as well spoke out quite strongly against those people who adopted the dress or had the external identity of Gaudiya Vaishnavas, but who in their ethical standards or in their devotional orientation did not possess the kind of Vaishnava qualities that he believed should be the standard. The kind of discussion or rhetoric of false or imitation Vaishnavas carried strongly through both Bhaktisiddhanta and Srila Prabhupada's writings as well. Right, so this is kind of one view, that Vaishnava is really an identity or a conversion process that's happening in a very internal, individual sense. Right? That's one. And this kind of view, we can cite different lectures, different letters of Srila Prabhupada particularly to back this up. So for instance, in a letter to Jayapataka from 1976, Srila Prabhupada talks about he quotes, "Christians also convert. It is not conversion from Christian to Hindu. We convert the atheist class of men to take God consciousness. God is one. It is not a question of Christianity, Hindu, Muslim. Any religion that teaches love to God is genuine. It has nothing to do with Hinduism, Islam, etc." Similarly, to Bali Mardana in 1971, he encourages, "Here in Bombay, we are registered as the International Society of Krishna Consciousness. Registration of our society is very essential, and you should see to it immediately. We are not converting Muslims. We do not convert. Is there any prohibition to preach Krishna philosophy to the Muslims? If anyone understands our philosophy, he will make his own conversion and find a way to do it. So, if there is no prohibition, then go ahead preaching our philosophy. That would be effective." This is even further elucidated in a lecture from 1968 in Montreal, where he quotes Savai Ponsan Paro Damo from the Bhagavatam. And says it doesn't matter whether you are following Christian religion, or Hindu religion, or Muslim religion, or any religion. It doesn't matter. Dharma means religion. That is the English translation. But actually, Dharma means that which you cannot change. Maybe this harkens back to Jiva Dharma. Religion, the so-called religion, is a sentiment. Today you are Hindu, tomorrow you become Muslim. Or today you are Muslim, tomorrow you become Christian. That kind of conversion, change, is not religion, because the man remains the same. Simply by changing the rubber stamp, "I am Hindu, I am Muslim, I am Christian," that does not make any benefit, Prabhupada quotes. Therefore, our movement is Krishna consciousness. We don't talk of any religion. That the consciousness should be changed. The material consciousness should be changed into spiritual consciousness. That is our propaganda. It is meant for everyone, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, anyone, because it is the function of the soul. So, how do we square this very non-sectarian, universal notion of conversion with the external identity of a convert, changing one's name, one's dress, one's association, beliefs, practices, cultural standards? Joseph O'Connell, as I mentioned earlier, also locates prema bhakti, loving devotion to Krishna, as the basic value orientation of Chaitanya Vaishnavism. And he discusses the institutionalization of the processes by which this value orientation is embedded into institutions and thereby made replicable and transferable to persons across time and space. This he finds in the utilization of religious literature, shastra, so on, and what he calls a complex repertoire of recommended devotional practices or sadhana. So through shastra and sadhana, this understanding of prema bhakti as a core value is, propagated and passed on. Though as Pranava was speaking yesterday about Bhaktisiddhanta's views on preaching and conversion, I was noticing the same tension that seems to run through how the meaning of conversion is measured or perceived in ISKCON, and that this was also very much an issue that Bhaktisiddhanta hoped to reconcile. This morning, Yama Lok also brought up quite clearly what one could call more of a discriminating or exclusivist aspect that Gaudiya Vaishnavism has had traditionally toward conversion, and what converted religious identity means for Chaitanya Vaishnavas in their movement. Which draw clear lines between the path of bhakti in the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition on the one hand and other cultures or religious members on the other. Perhaps this is really a continuing issue of how to institutionalize prema, our core value orientation, and whether one can adequately achieve that. I suppose the typical answer would be to say that one should balance one's internal devotional commitment with demonstrations of external commitment, moving along both tracks at once, both processes at once. But I think it's interesting that when I was, just before I came here, happened to be at the manor and met Raghunath Swami, and just to give a sense of, a popular current interpretation of conversion within Gaudiya Vaishnavism, when I asked him, what do you think, how would you define conversion or the essence of conversion for the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition? He alluded again back to Savai Punsam Parodhamo Amyato Bhakti Arpokshate, that bhakti is at the core of what we're talking about, and it's not an issue of religious identity. But he also said that, for at least in his opinion, it was actually the greatest need of conversion within ISKCON that was the greatest need of our day. And what does that mean? He meant, people who are already practicing Gaudiya Vaishnavas, beginning to develop true prema bhakti, beginning to delve deeper into the tradition and take up devotional service in a sincere and thorough manner. So this seems to bring into clear focus the nuanced understanding of what conversion means for many Gaudiya Vaishnavas, I would say, in the current context. Conversion is not merely, or even most importantly, a matter of joining an institution or an organization, but does indeed have a lot to do with our personal practice of prema bhakti. Yet the tension remains, and perhaps we can discuss that a little bit more now. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? Yep, this one. Speak loud.
Okay. Just one small point before my question. You use Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya as sort of an example of a conversion through, well, I suppose through theology or through sort of it's interesting that Kavikarnapur doesn't depict it like that at all. For him, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya converted through experience, and then the theology came later. Then that's just a minor point. My question is just something I'd like to throw out there and see what you have to say on it. You started with the Protestant sort of notion of conversion, sort of an individual thing, sort of a drastic change and this and that, and then contrasted that with some other models of conversion, and you said something about cultural backgrounds and that influencing your way of looking at conversion. And the question that sort of came up in my mind was, if there are different models of conversion, and if some models of conversion have not been found in, say, the Bengali homelands of our tradition, does that necessarily mean that those types of conversion that have not been found there are necessarily sort of either non-traditional or even anti-traditional? Could one say that there's a certain cultural background that one carries with them? If I grew up in a Protestant culture, and I have a certain notion of conversion, and I apply that to Krishna consciousness, I become a practicing Vaishnava with that whole understanding. Is there something wrong with that?
Thank you, that's a really interesting question. And it kind of brings up this notion, I guess, until recently in scholarship in general, I talked about the notion of culture boxes, religions as culture boxes. There's been a broad tendency to see religions as, monolithic entities that don't change over time and place, or to see religion as a particular, like, let's say, Christianity in its purest form is to be found in the Roman Catholic Church. But Christianity in Africa, has adopted all these strange practices that don't look like Roman Catholicism, and therefore it must be syncretism. It must be, a diluted form of real Christianity. So I also wonder, and that's an interesting question in our case, does one's particular cultural background delegitimate the effectiveness of conversion? I mean, if we were to say that only models of conversion that we can find in the Chittagita Metta or find in early Bengali texts are adequate or authentic, I think practically none of us would, you know, be considered adequate or authentic Vaishnavas. Seem to be popular by these slides. I would say no, it doesn't delegitimate it, but I think we probably have to just scrutinize and look closely at what baggage we have with us. But I don't think we have to do that any more than anyone else has to. I mean, a Bengali converting to Chaitanya Vaishnavism would also have their own particular baggage, from a particular cultural context. So do you have any further thoughts on that? Or what were you getting at with your question? Yeah.
No, it's just something that came to mind, and I was curious what you had to say on it.
Yeah, and I think in certain ways, I didn't elaborate terribly on the Protestant notion of conversion, but in certain ways, if we look at conversion as praying bhakti for our tradition and as a personal relationship with Krishna, there are parallels, to the Christian traditional notion of conversion as well. And I think, as you demonstrated in your presentation, we have to be careful not to just kind of equate things without, looking deeply into what they mean for each tradition. So, any other thoughts?
I'm not sure if it's
A great many years ago, and I couldn't tell you what the source is, but I'm sure it must have been a Protestant source. The definition of conversion was represented to me as the turning of the heart from the world to God, which I think is consistent with much of what you were saying towards the end of your lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that there are a great many different possible markers of that turning.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us have been given the status of official symbols, and many of them are less formal. But it seems to me that you can explain a lot of the variations in the notion of conversion if you adopt as your primary definition a spiritual, I would call a spiritual definition, which is the turning of the heart or the soul, whatever your conception of structure of the personality is, from the desire for the world into a desire for God. And then you can organize various kinds of external symptoms that different people will recognize according to the different sort of categories that you use to analyze. It could be sociological, it could be intellectual, etc. I was just curious how that fits with your overall sense of what you've concluded on the basis of all your research.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I actually came across that definition as well in the course of this research. But I guess what I feel is that, there is that spiritual aspect, what we might call the spiritual aspect of the heart, that has been coming with, following through our tradition in tension with this other, focus on the external aspects of conversion. Perhaps, as you said, these could be manifestations or representations of an internal change. But I guess I would be hesitant to talk about conversion as exclusively that internal spiritual state, partly because it's hard, to measure. I mean, how do you know then? And I mean, maybe that's in our tradition where we would fall back on the notion of a spiritually realized person who can see, the content of a person's heart. But I guess what I wanted to end with more was a type of question to you all in terms of that tension that has been in our tradition. Rather than locating conversion specifically only in an internal spiritual state, just to ask you what you think about, how should we use this notion of conversion? How should we understand it? Maybe some of you, agree that it should be viewed as a change of heart exclusively. But I think institutionally, I have a feeling that the GBC is not going to go for that, probably as the exclusive definition. So, but I think certainly it would be at the heart of what for many would be.
Well, I think for me, you really identified the core issue, and that is that as soon as you mention the word institution, I'll measure my words here. You're dealing with a construction of human beings in order to perpetuate a certain social phenomenon. And an institution has its own needs. And in the end, it survives by fulfilling its own needs. And if people are attracted to serve the needs of the institution, and can do so very successfully for many, many generations. And I think that's one kind of human experience is institutional existence. I mean, it is a creation of human beings, after all. So I think from an institutional point of view, you could have one definition of a conversion. Clearly, in the world at large of churches and congregations and whatnot, you don't become a Catholic if you were a Hindu just by saying, I now love God, and I didn't before. There's a whole institutional process of conversion. So I didn't mean to imply the lie of saying that there's only one right definition of conversion, but I do think it's useful to think about what's the perspective from which you define the term.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Going back to what you were saying about your what you found the Chaitanya Charitamrita. I was really struck when I was working on a chapter of my book on the role of non-sankirtana and kind of going back to the sources and looking at what relationship, of course, the representations of Chaitanya himself and the role of the name there, and then looking at the Goswamis and Jiva and Rupa in particular. And what I was really struck by, and I think you and I talked about this, was the centrality completely. Full centrality of the name in Chaitanya's practice and the way it was represented by Krishnadas Kaviraj. And what you were saying earlier, just what I was struck by also, was the way in which, in a sense, the community he would move from place to place. He'd go down to South India, and as you were saying, the community would come, be attracted, and just start chanting the name and become Vaishnavas. And then, as you said, they would go to their community, and then they would start chanting, and they would become Vaishnavas. And the simplicity of the process, as you were talking about, that the sense that then they became a community bound together, as says at one point, by the garland of the name, and you know, just the sense of that was the community. And then, of course, there are other ways in which the community, there were levels of the community in terms of the way in which the Sangha organized itself, you could see some differentiation within the community. But basically, it was just the practice of the name. But then, what I was struck by was when I started looking at the Goswamis, and of course the name is very important there too, but it's part of a larger network of practices. Because the Goswamis are then, they have they're given the task to basically develop the systematic theology and the sadhana. And so they develop a whole system of sadhana, and the practice of the name is one aspect, but it's not the sole aspect. And so, I mean, I guess I was thinking that, you know, in a way you think of Chaitanya's role, and then you think of the institutionalization through the role of the Goswamis, and they then set up the sadhana, they set up, you know, the more systematic study of shastra. I mean, something very different happens there. It seems to me, you know, that what would, what I call it, conversion look like once the institutionalization is taken place, right? Now you have sadhana and bhakti, you have certain centralized practices, the name is one of those, chanting the name, But it seems to me there's a kind of two-tiered level even within the history of the tradition.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much. And that's a very important point. Also, even going on to the Goswami's looking, I did do some looking into the Bhakti Ratnakar as well, which is kind of the next generation of early Gaudiya Vaishnavas. And there the influence, the inspiration for them is really spreading the teachings of the Goswamis or the books of the Goswamis now. So you see a much more complex notion of what one is converted to or the process of becoming a Chaitanya Vaishnava. And I think that's the point you brought up is also probably a very interesting point for us as a group to discuss. To what extent, has our tradition developed, just even in the first few generations? And what aspects, Joseph O'Connell, again, in his article about institutionalizing Prema Bhakti, talks about, changes that have occurred, also in the last 100, 200 years. And sometimes we talk about Bhakti Vinod Thakur and Bhakti Siddhanta as, reformers, in a sense, Vaishnava reformers in the tradition, who introduced a lot of, processes of institutionalization, initiation processes, sannyas processes, and again, kind of reinterpreted that tradition for the particular context of the time. So, all of this has come down to us in many different channels. And I wonder, I guess there is this tension over to what extent do you then place your exclusive focus on the holy name? I think, I wonder, in terms of speaking with someone like Giriraj Swami or other, senior members of this camp, would they say that it was the central focus, or do you think they would say it was one focus among many?
Well, I remember when I worked on this, Jeff, it became an article, and I gave Giriraj Swami a talk, and I was curious to see how he would relate to it. Partly because my argument was that, just looking at the texts themselves, that clearly Krishnadas Kaviraj and the central practice of Chaitanya was not Sankirtana. There was no question, at least in that, looking just at that text. But when I went to the Goswamis, I made the argument that I saw that Namasankirtana was one important element that was incorporated into this larger network of practices. And then we just look at the five central practices. Obviously, Namasankirtana or Namakirtana is there as one of these five central practices. But the Bhagavata and the role of the Bhagavata, the role of Murtiseva, the role of Rajadharma, these other elements come into play and are also talked about. And I didn't see the kind of the name in certain places in the Bhaktisandarbha, Jiggy talks about how important the name is, but I didn't see that it was like, this is the central practice to take precedence over all other practices. I didn't see that. And actually, I had one conversation with Giriraj Swami about the article that I wrote, and he didn't have a problem with that. And we didn't really zero in on that, but I just found it interesting, to think about in terms of the focus with it is obviously on the practice, but Murtiseva, of course, is there, and the emphasis on Vraja is there. But I just didn't see within the Goswamis and the way in which they were developing the tradition. And it's partly because they had the responsibility to develop a whole network of practices, that I didn't see that the name was really singled out as the central, most important practice among all the practices. I didn't find that, actually.
That's an interesting point. And I wonder also, going back again to this notion of a lack of centralized authority traditionally in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, and whether that has also created the ability for there to be various ways of practicing or focusing within. Because as you speak, I think about people who would strongly argue that the name is central, but others who might argue that Murtiseva is more central, or another aspect of our various tradition. That is a very important point. Thank you very much.
I just want to interject one more thing. You mentioned that there's conversion and how we want to frame that, but there's also the initiation. You mentioned initiation. It seems to me that, again, the institutionalized process of, for Jiva Goswami talks about initiation, and Bhaktisiddhanta already mentions it, sort of takes for granted it's happening. But what I mean, if you think of the distinction between, say, see the way in which Chaitanya is just gathering people around him and they're taking up the name and they're chanting and then they're Vaishnavas. And that didn't seem to talk about it. There's no talk about some initiation process, at least it was formalized. It doesn't, at least in the way it's represented in the kind of biographical narrative. But certainly Jiva talks about initiation. So again, that there you have a kind of formalized moment. It could be a person's turning that brings them to the community, but then there's a formalization of that. And then, of course, you have the different levels of initiation. But initiation, I think, is important. And I'm not sure what is initiation conversion. I mean, is that the formalized moment of conversion? Is it comparable to when you convert to become a Catholic? You have, if you're a Methodist and you become a Catholic, you have to be baptized. You don't have to be baptized. You do have to go through a formalized ceremony, but you have to be baptized. But if you're not a Christian and you become a Catholic, you have to be baptized, then you have to go through the conversion. I mean, but the point is, what are we talking about? Are we talking about, again, this word is inward turning? Are we talking about a formalized moment when you're entering, like we say, a formalized moment entering into community, and then the community is determining what is necessary, you know, for that, you know, to be both this among member.
Yeah, and I guess that's, I mean, just to respond, that's kind of where I see this paradox, that you know, on the one hand, there is this very developed notion of initiation and conversion in that sense, and you know, following the 64 principles and, you know, having a very externally, you know, precise identity as a Gaudiya Vaishnava. On the other hand, as a bhakti tradition, there's this type of outlet that allows, you know, Prabhupada to say St. Francis is a Vaishnava, even though he, you know, clearly was not a practicing Gaudiya Vaishnava in any sense of the term externally. So yeah, that's where I kind of see this tension there. Because on the one hand, there's this very developed theology and ritual practice literature, but on the other hand, there's this kind of outlet for that simplistic notion of, I don't want to say simplistic, but simple, sort of straight, straightforward notion of taking up bhakti as an individual as well. And so, yeah, those two seem to be really acting in tension in our tradition. Thank you for
I'm wondering if you have been looking at the history of the notion of conversion, whatever you want to call it. Because it seems to me that your papers is going to be entirely different if you accept, because to address those phenomena as conversions or change, that implies that you are subscribing to something that previously was accepted as being something. Well, the main institutions that are concerned with the identity are institutions, and therefore conversion comes from institutions, the notion of conversions, whatever you want to call it, even if you're not using conversion or initiation or any other frame that mark the difference between before and after, comes from institutions. So it seems to me that you are like within a circle with no escape here, because the texts that you're reading are written by testimonies, so-called, that are describing phenomena that are reflecting their own interests on being, describing themselves being converted or asking you to convert to something else. So it seems to me that here both notions, conversion or whatever you want to call it, comes from the same source. So it's very difficult to, because like being an historian, early Buddhist Pali canons, you have famous passages where, you know, the apostles, let me call them like that, of the Buddhas went around and came back after Deshavijaya, converting lands. And they had fields. Well, I got 40,000 lay monks and 15,000 monks. No, I went down and I got 35,000, you know. And they were describing phenomena, so-called, we know nothing about, but we believe that those people were converted or changed something. And then you have, within the same text, problems in identifying people that are not that much converted. You know, the Dhammapada is talking about Brahmanas that are not Brahmanas properly. or Brahmana only by name, Brahmavan. Or, you know, it seems that symptoms are requested to identify those who are converted, but then at the same time, those symptoms are not that much here. Which means, let us the door open, but at the same time, we need to close them. So it's like an internal conversation going on here amongst converted to establish what conversion is about. And then, in the obvious, you have Marikata Vaigagya, you know, those who are renouncer externally, but not internally, which means the internal conversion didn't take place. So you need something like internal meter converter establisher. And, you know, it's really something strange to address this phenomenon like conversion, especially because asking you if you have been wondering about first to enter into this kind of a problem of conversion, like the Nitto Siddha Krishnavaram, the pacifist, this is at the center of a radical theological problem. Because if you are already there, and you need just to wake up, everything changed from the theological point of view, from the sadhana, from... So, it seems to me that, you know, conversion and what established the conversion is the heart of the entire theological, practical, institutional concern. With no way out. So...
Thank you. Thank you. And I think the vicious circle is actually even bigger, because as I was, I was asked to write this paper, it's not a topic that I'm studying otherwise, so that might be part of the reason why it's a little unclear. But one of the issues I was coming up against, I guess, in the line of Talal Asad's work on the history of modernity, the history of religion, or anthropology of religion, it's just the whole notion of, as you said, from within the institution, we have our certain notions of what conversion is or is not, and our own kind of measuring sticks for that. But also within our particular, cultural context or inheritance of, Western Academy, we also have our notions of what a religion is or is not. And so I tried to kind of bring it up with the Ismailis a little bit and with other groups that not only is conversion a difficult concept, but religion, the religious tradition is a very difficult concept, especially like the Ismailis, when you keep changing your definition of who you are and what kind of, what kind of membership or identity you actually have. So, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's a vicious circle, and it's something that is very hard to, I think, finally get a grasp on in any sort of definitive sense. Absolutely. Right. But I think we have...
I'm afraid
to 2 minutes. Okay. Thank you very much for your patience.